Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first three meals free.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you had a wonderful weekend. It was a contemplative, reflective weekend, I think, for most of America, thinking about what's transpired over the last week and what to expect going forward. And that's for people who voted for Donald Trump and for people who voted for Hillary Clinton. What do we know? Well, we know that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by close to a million votes at this point. And when all votes are counted, it could exceed 2 million votes. We know that the Electoral College has made this election a contest, or it seemed to be a contest, between a rural, largely white America and an urban, largely multicultural America. We know that there are large-scale protests in cities around the country that show no signs of ending. We know there are specific communities in the United States who are afraid of the Trump presidency, among them African Americans and Muslims. How realistic are those fears? Well, that we don't know. We do know that former RNC chief Reince Priebus is Donald Trump's chief of staff and that Stephen Bannon is Trump's chief strategist. What's a chief strategist? We don't know exactly. But we do know that Bannon is a leader of the alt-right movement and a member of that white nationalist group told us last week what he believes the first steps of the Trump administration should be.
What we're seeing now with this Trump presidency is an awakening of white identity.
That's Paul Ramsey on The Takeaway last week in the alt-right movement. We know that Trump has now pledged he will build the wall and begin the deportation of, at first, 2 million undocumented workers who he says are criminals. From what we already know about President-elect Donald Trump's immigration plans, he is definitely on a collision course with cities around the U.S. The approximately 300 cities and local jurisdictions which explicitly leave the enforcement of undocumented immigrants to federal agents, sanctuary cities they're called. Mayors from Seattle, New York, and San Francisco have come out to condemn Trump's threat of mass deportation and to reassure immigrants that they will continue to be protected by law enforcement in those sanctuary cities. Bessie Hodges, the mayor of Minneapolis, is one of them, and she says that Trump's plans for undocumented workers will cause mayhem.
We have had an ordinance since 2003 in Minneapolis that our police officers aren't going to do the work of the federal immigration folks, that it is a question of public safety, because if immigrant folks, if anybody doesn't feel safe calling the police, if witnesses to crime, if victims of crime can't call the police and feel safe, then we are a less safe city overall. President-elect Trump has pledged to withhold federal funding from any city that carries on this practice, or I assume others, that would protect folks in their cities. And that's not acceptable if I care about public safety in Minneapolis, and I do.
How much money would that represent in your city?
You know, we are doing the calculations on that right now, but clearly it's in the millions of dollars, yeah.
And if the federal government were to come in and do what they say and the president-elect says they should do, and that is find the undocumented workers and deport them, how disruptive do you believe that would be in your city?
Well, of course, that would be hugely disruptive. The methods that folks have to use to try and determine status, et cetera, is hugely disruptive in any city. And it makes the city less safe. And it, you know, economies all across this country rely on making sure we have immigrant workers. So, yeah, plus it would be terrifying for people who live here, because even if they have documentation or not, it is a terrifying thing to think that we're living in a world where we're going to have invading people coming in and you know, trying to assess whether or not you are the proper American.
So it would be the equivalent of a kind of federal stormtrooper initiative to do what the president-elect says he wants to do in cities around the United States if you're a sanctuary city.
That is, you know, all that I can imagine. President-elect Trump has not been clear on exactly what it is he's going to do or how he's going to do it. But yes, he is making lots of threats about people. All of those are going to erode public safety, regardless of his other goals. He is placing politics before public safety.
President-elect Trump says that the 2 million people he wants to deport immediately are all criminals anyway, and that you would want them deported. You would want them out of your communities.
There are processes that people go through if they are, if they have committed crimes, if they are criminals. There are processes that our law, or, you know, that our systems already have in place to assess that. And if President-elect Trump wants to work within the systems that already exist for federal government and local government, that's one thing. But to do this in the absence of comprehensive immigration reform, to do this in the absence of something that people all across this country want, are clamoring for, is to have a piecemeal strategy for a solution that needs an overall strategy.
Do you think it's possible that, you know, in his heart of hearts, he really doesn't want this fight, and that he understands your position maybe even better than you do, although he's not going to say it?
I would not presume to try and understand what goes through the mind or the heart of Donald Trump.
He's not your president?
He is not the president I supported or voted for, and the things that he says, the things that he's done, and the things that he stands for, I reject with everything I've got. You know, this is unique. This is a person whose personal behavior, self-admittedly, has been atrocious and illegal. This is somebody who has pledged to attack and go after women and minorities and immigrants and Muslims and people with disabilities, and I could go on. That's not the America I believe in. That's not the America I stand for.
That's an invitation to a real collision course, it would seem, between Washington and your cities.
I think that mayors all across the country right now are assessing what impact a Trump presidency can and will have on our cities, and are doing our best to prepare for that. But, you know, the people of Minneapolis have been clear about what our values are. We are clear about who we are as a people. And I will work with, I will always have a hand extended. I always have a hand extended. But the question is, will there be a hand extended back? And so far, the answer has been no.
Betsy Hodges is the mayor of Minneapolis, Minnesota. Something else we know is there's a hole right now in the Democratic Party. And could a Minnesota congressman named Keith Ellison fill it? Ellison warned that Trump could be a disaster for a passive Hillary Clinton-oriented Democratic Party. He warned this back in 2015.
All I want to say is that anybody from the Democratic side of the fence who's terrified of the possibility of President Trump better vote, better get active, better get involved, because this man has got some momentum, and we better be ready for the fact that he might be leading the Republican ticket.
Next, I know you don't believe that, but I want to go on to
Sorry to laugh.
George, we had Jesse Ventura in Minnesota win the governorship. Nobody thought he was going to win. I'm telling you, stranger things have happened.
Nobody's laughing now. Who will head the Democratic Party now in disarray? President-elect Donald Trump has named two of his first hires. We mentioned GOP Chairman Reince Priebus will be chief of staff, and Stephen Bannon will have a West Wing office as chief strategist and senior counsel to the president. Bannon, as we mentioned, was the chairman of the alt-right news website Breitbart.com before joining the Trump campaign as CEO in August. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Let's start with the Democrats first. Can Ellison fill the hole?
John, Keith Ellison is going to make an announcement today about his intentions. He already has the support of some heavy hitters in the Democratic Party, including Chuck Schumer, the next Democratic leader, Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren. There are other people running, too, besides Keith Ellison. By the way, he's a congressman from Minneapolis, Minnesota. He's Muslim, the first elected Muslim in the United States Congress. Martin O'Malley, the former governor of Maryland, is likely to throw his hat in the ring. And Howard Dean, who ran the DNC from 05 to 09 and was credited with the 50-state strategy that expanded Democratic appeal and built up their technology database for the first time to get them a lot of new voters and donors. So you're likely to see those three, if not more people.
And this shifts the Democratic Party to a more progressive stance, do you think, or is it too early to tell?
it's too early to tell because there's, you know, you really are going to have to go to the state chairs. One of the concerns about Ellison is that he's a congressman. A lot of people think DNC chairman is a full-time job. Also, forget about Washington for a second. The Democratic Party is in trouble in state legislatures across the country. The Republicans now control 32 state legislatures. They're close to the point, John, where they could start ratifying constitutional amendments. That's red alert time for Democrats. So it's not just about who satisfies the Chuck Schumers and Elizabeth Warrens in the Capitol and in Washington. It really is about the state leaders, too.
Well, who does Reince Priebus being GOP chief of staff or chief of staff for Donald Trump's president-elect staff right now? Who does that satisfy? And who does Stephen Bannon being the chief strategist for president-elect Trump? Who does that satisfy?
So Reince Priebus satisfies a lot of establishment people around Washington. And indeed, when people reacted to the announcement last night, most of them congratulated Reince Priebus, the current head of the RNC, and ignored the appointment of Bannon. Nobody mentioned it. Now, when Donald Trump announced this last night, John, he announced Bannon and Priebus as co-equal partners in advising him in the Oval Office. That's the way it was in the press release. And indeed, Bannon's name was first. But here's the concern about Steve Bannon. The concern is that he's a white supremacist and has led a white nationalist movement on the internet with his leadership of Breitbart News. The Southern Poverty Law Center last night, John, warned that Steve Bannon was responsible for making Breitbart the mouthpiece of the white nationalist movement. And what's at issue here really is Bannon's own statements in his life and how Breitbart News performed when he was in charge. When Bannon was executive chairman of Breitbart News, they had a section entitled Black Crime. That was a vertical on Breitbart News. They had headlines that included things like birth control makes women unattractive and crazy. They called Gabby Giffords the gun control movement's human shield. There was a headline that said there's no hiring bias against women in tech. They just suck at interviews. And another headline referred to Republican commentator and former strategist Bill Kristol as a renegade Jew. But John, it's also a lot of Steve Bannon's own statements throughout his career that's caused a lot of alarm among people who now know that he will be right next to the president as a co-equal advisor to Reince Priebus. Bannon's estranged wife in 2007 testified under oath that he didn't want their daughter going to a particular private school because there were too many Jewish children there and that he didn't like Jews. That was her testimony. When Steve Bannon had a satellite radio show also, he regularly entertained guests who trafficked in anti-Muslim conspiracy theories, including one that Hillary Clinton advisor Huma Abedin was a Saudi spy. Now, last night after this news came out, Muslim and Jewish groups both decried the appointment by Donald Trump of Steve Bannon as senior advisor. And John, one last thing. I picked this up off of Twitter last night. The chief strategist to Republican Ohio Governor John Kasich, a guy named John Weaver, attacked the choice last night, and he said this. He said, just to be clear, the next president has named a racist anti-Semite as the co-equal to the chief of staff. That came from the Ohio governor's chief strategist, John.
Todd Zulik, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
You got it, John.
What do we know about Donald Trump's foreign policy? Precious little. The president-elect says he got calls from every major world leader since last Tuesday, and that's to be expected. Since the Second World War, the U.S. has been both a keeper and defender of the international order. But is the Trump administration a step back from that keeper and defender of international order role? Jeet Hirsch says it is. He's a senior editor at The New Republic. He believes President-elect Trump will usher in a new period of world disorder.
It's true that there's already a lot of disorder and that America has a hard time policing it. I think it's also the case that America has alliances and that these are, you know, sort of undergird by treaties and by agreements. And I think that's what Trump wants to do away with. So I think that it has the real potential to take what is already kind of happening in the Middle East and spread it to Asia and Europe. Especially with, you know, the idea of making NATO a sort of pay-as-you-go enterprise and perhaps not necessarily supporting longstanding American policy of opposing Russian expansion there.
But hasn't Putin already forced NATO's hand in terms of what NATO's limitations are in moving eastward? And that Trump is simply saying, you know, we're done with this NATO expansion and we can't afford the NATO as it exists.
I'm not a fan of NATO expansion. I think it sort of has caused America a lot of difficulty. But I think that his conception of NATO is as a kind of protection racket. And that seems kind of like new, like to say, like, well, if you want to be defended, you pony up the dough. And I think that conception of foreign policy really does make America more like an imperial power, and maybe even like a sort of mafia don rather than, you know, a nation that has a conception of trying to create a more peaceful and orderly world.
Well, it's kind of six of one, half a dozen of the other. I mean, you're either, I mean, is it really that important? I mean, it sounds like an academic distinction, but whether you're a don, a queen, a president, or a guy named Donald Trump, you know, pay me and I'll keep the Chinese off your back. It sounds the same.
I don't know. I mean, I do actually think, I think there's a lot of problems with American foreign policy and the way it's been carried on. But it's also the case that, you know, under this sort of American protective umbrella, we've allowed liberal democracies to flourish in places like Western Europe and in parts of Asia, like Japan and South Korea. And it's a real question as to what happens if that protective umbrella is withdrawn.
Let's think about that, though. Who's more likely to be abandoned under the Trump New World Disorder? Is it the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, or is it Taiwan?
I'd say the Baltic states.
Really?
Well, yes. I think his interest in pursuing a sort of, you know, friendly relationship with Putin's Russia is a very serious part of his plank, I think, and his outlook on the world. And I think that the way he's talked about NATO, it's a real possibility.
What should the U.S. at all costs maintain? Its presence in South Korea, its defense of Taiwan, or its patrol of the Pacific as a counterbalance to China?
I would say defending South Korea is probably has sort of a priority.
So the others could kind of go by the wayside.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure if it's like an either or thing. Like in some ways, you kind of need one to have the other, right?
Well, it's a chicken and egg question, if you ask me. I mean, the question is how much of this is driven by Trump and his ideas about protectionism, which I hear you aren't terribly sophisticated. But how much of this is just a recognition that some of this stuff is just kind of obsolete? We're not in a position to do what some of these treaties say anymore. And it's a question of who's going to call whose bluff. And I mean, I don't know. I'd rather not spend the money on thousands of aircraft carriers if we're just pretending to defend Taiwan. And I don't want to go to war over Taiwan. So, I mean, is this altogether a bad thing?
If you say you don't want to go to war over Taiwan, so what you're basically saying is you're okay with a world in which the Chinese government invades Taiwan, right? And so you're okay with a world in which a democracy gets extinguished. But the question, though, is like once you go down that road, you're going to have, you know, a much more cutthroat world. And in a world where like the level of uncertainty is much greater. I mean, also, this is would be like kind of like a raw territorial conquest. I don't know. I mean, like I feel like the sort of taboo or the idea that one nation shouldn't just be able to swallow up another is a very powerful presumption that we've tried to create since World War II.
Jeet Heer is a senior editor at The New Republic. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
In the years since the attack that killed 130 people and wounded another 368 in Paris, has that city changed? The early answer is yes. And the changes are evident in everything from the feeling on the streets of Paris to the political confusion evident in the rhetoric leading up to the presidential election in France just around the corner. Samuel Laurent is the author of Al-Qaeda in France.
Actually, Paris and France have changed a lot, and not for the better. I would say that after a year, a lot of budget has been devoted to defense and counterterrorism. We got 10,000 soldiers patrolling on the streets, exercise for managing a terror plot in the schools. We got a lot of measure to try to make things better, but actually the fear is worst. There is one point that every French is very aware of, is that we had a lot of fighters in Iraq and in Syria. Now, their number is estimated to 2,000. And actually, all the operations now in Mosul and also in Syria are just pushing this flow back to Europe and especially to France. So this is one of the main concerns right now.
So there's concern in France that the uptick in military activity is going to lead to another attack.
Definitely, for many reasons. First of all, because obviously the ISIS propaganda is calling for it. And in the past, we have saw that the propaganda is very carefully followed by ISIS sympathizers in Europe, but also because all those battle-hardened people, as I say, numbering in the thousand, will most likely come back to France, come back to Belgium, another hotbed of terror, unfortunately, and to other European countries. The borders in Europe do not exist anymore. So definitely we're going to have a very large pool of radicalized and battle-hardened people to manage. And definitely for now, our intelligence and security services are not up to the task.
And what does that mean for domestic politics? A national election is about to start in the next couple of weeks. Mr. Hollande is at a popularity point that is lower than almost any time in French post-war history. Is this an invitation to take a more nationalist track? Is it an opportunity for Marine Le Pen?
Definitely. Actually, Mr. Hollande is not at one of the lowest points in history. He is at the lowest point ever noticed in history. And actually, French are very disillusioned about his policies. The problem is that the right doesn't sound very coordinated and very disciplined. It is lost in bickering and in political infighting about who's going to be the candidate for the next election. So therefore, it's losing a lot of credibility. So the left has a disastrous mandate. The right did not seize the opportunity to basically build back some credit and capitalize on the weakness of the left during its time in power. So obviously, yes, we would say in French that Marine Le Pen has an avenue now. The point is that French politics are designed in such a way that most likely we will not see the same thing than in the U.S. Like Marine Le Pen will most likely go to the second round, but then the coalitions will be much more effective against her, like the left, the right, the extreme left, all those parties and the one in the middle. All of them will coalize and basically will block her on the second round. So the chance of having her really in power after second round of election is extremely tiny.
Samuel Laurent, author of Al-Qaeda in France, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
We're going to spend the rest of this hour considering what will be the Trump policy toward Muslims in America. Will the fight against terrorism become a much closer monitoring of Muslim communities around the country? Communities that have already expressed fear over the election of Donald Trump. Ashra Nomani is a former Wall Street Journal reporter, co-founder of the Muslim Reform Movement, and author of Standing Alone, an American Women's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. She voted for Donald Trump and shared her reasons why in a widely read Washington Post opinion piece. She says she voted for Trump because he may represent a more realistic way of dealing with fears that are too often shut down by what she calls the identity politics of the American left.
Well, the way I put it is that I voted for Donald Trump. You know, I'm a journalist, as you know, and I have equal opportunity skepticism and cynicism about politicians and bureaucrats and political leaders. And so I voted for him as the best choice that I faced last Tuesday. And I stand by my vote, but I will watch very carefully and consider myself, you know, a ombudsman of sorts to make sure that we preserve ideas of human rights and individual rights and liberal values that America is so proud to be a part of.
So it sounds to me, and that's a little bit theoretical, that You're willing to listen to Mr. Bannon's approach to what should happen in immigration and as far as the vetting of Muslims is concerned in the United States. And you're not inclined to listen to charges that he made anti-Semitic statements at some time in the past. That you're much more interested in what he's going to say now that he's appointed to this post.
Oh, I'm absolutely interested in everything. Like I said, I'm equal opportunity. But at the same time, you know, he's in position now, right? Like there's going to be a trial in the court of public opinion and he's going to be removed, which is not likely, right? Like that sounds like what folks on the left are trying to accomplish, and it's not going to happen. I mean, this demagoguery continues and it continues to avoid any kind of conversation about the issues at heart. You know, the one dear to my heart is the issue of Islamic extremism. So let's just use that as an example. But I care also very much about issues of illegal immigration here. So on Islamic extremism, we can continue to play this game and do this dance that there's no Islam in the Islamic State. And the right will continue to have its really tough, strong, aggressive policies. Or we can acknowledge that there's an ideological problem that is a very minority part of our population, and we can then isolate that, just as extremists in all communities have to be isolated, and defeat it. That's our choice. And so I'm not going to just sit back and wait for policy changes. I'm going to do all that I can in my power to try to engage those that are in decision-making, to move them to a place of humanity about these different decisions. But at the same time, on the left, we have to really acknowledge that there's an entire population of people, including me, who are seriously concerned about the refugee issue and extremism and our illegal immigration population here in the U.S. I feel deep compassion and heart for all of those issues, but at the same time, there's also pragmatic solutions we have to find instead of just this shutting down of debate.
Listen, I'm not dehumanizing the alt-right movement. I'm not dehumanizing them. They're here. I'm saying this is what they recommend to purge Islamic terrorism from the United States. And I'm not doing trash talk against you or anyone or any Trump voter. The message of the election is, who are we in the United States? The message of the election is not, here come the fascists. I'm clear about that. But what I just want to know from you, what you're going to say if the Trump mission becomes mass deportations, building of walls, at which Trump has already said he's going to build the wall and he's going to start with the deportations. Sanctuary cities are ready for the deportation collision. And then the question becomes, are Islamic communities going to be disrupted and surveilled as the target of Islamic terrorism when the Orlando attack and the San Bernardino attack none of the attacks in the United States had anything to do with a kind of systematic tolerance of Islamic terrorism in mosques around the United States.
That's the narrative that's presented. I mean, the way you present it, John, is absolutely that the sky is falling. But no, I don't believe that we're going to have mass deportations. I mean, already Donald Trump has said that he's going to be looking at the folks that have criminal records, which I think some people might have some agreement with, and especially folks that are in the middle on the issue of San Bernardino in Orlando. The couple and San Bernardino and Omar Mateen in Orlando were radicalized. The narrative has become that they were not radicalized at mosque.
Who would have turned them in? I mean, what systematic program is going to like turn in the Orlando terrorists or the San Bernardino terrorists? And 2 million people with criminal records. Donald Trump saying he's going to deport is mass deportation. That's not the sky
thing,
is falling.
Like I don't feel, and I love you, but I don't feel that. I feel like this is exactly the point at which the conversation has been deteriorating in America, because I'm trying to express from my perspective the challenge and the reality that we have of Islamic extremist ideology in our communities, in our mosques, in our families. And the pushback, which I understand is from your perspective very real, that it doesn't exist as I'm saying that it does. So there's hardly any place to go then, because I'm saying to you that it does happen. It is here. I go to mosques and they still think that the Jews did 9/11. And so those are realities that we're not allowed to talk about, because
we're absolutely allowed to talk about it, and we're talking about it here. For me, the question is what approach is going to change that? Are you saying that imams who declare that 9/11 was accomplished by Jews should be deported from the United States, should be arrested, that people such as the FBI should go to the mosques in Manassas and listen to those sermons and then arrest and interrogate those people, that's something that we're going to be doing now?
I know, as a Muslim, I'm saying that we need to sit in those mosques and we need to monitor what's being said and we need to challenge our imams, and then we absolutely have to, you know, see something, say something. You know, if we believe that there is anybody who is radicalizing any individual, whether it is from our white extremist communities or whether it's from our Muslim communities, we have to stand up. What am I expressing is that over 8 years, I believe that we have failed in having a rational conversation and solution on these issues of Islamic extremism. Under the Obama administration, we have had a lobby and special interest groups that have pushed back on any kind of law enforcement activity. And so I understand the limits that we need to have in society, but I also understand the threat. And what I'm trying to just explain is that influenced my vote, and I believe the vote of many other people, so that if we're trying to dissect what happened last Tuesday, I think this would be good to try to understand.
Are you going to feel better if law enforcement has a much freer hand to observe and profile Muslims in the United States with the intent of preventing Islamic terrorism and radicalization from happening in the United States, all the way down to monitoring speech like the Jews did 9/11?
So this is one of those moments when, you know, I feel like there's a right answer and a wrong answer, and then there's my answer. And my answer is that I am more comfortable with law enforcement beefing up its enforcement policies. I've had this debate over the last 8 years, and it's always turned as, if you want any more rational threat assessment, if you want any more rational surveillance put in place that does not, you know, deny people's civil liberties in this country and maintains, you know, the law, of course, you're immediately anti-Muslim. And thus the debate is shut down. The FBI has had to clear its training dockets. It's had to clear its policies. The NYPD has had to reverse its policies. I know you're well familiar with that. And it's not just, you know, a lawsuit. These are well-funded operations that have been put in place to basically challenge law enforcement in this country. And I'm on the side of, you know, a safer society through pragmatic, rational means. And unfortunately, I believe that the identity politics of the day have made it so that everybody is just shut down and we can't even have the conversation. And then going back to your first point, the alt-right rises. And I just believe that a little bit of soul searching on the side of the left would allow us to then understand that, you know, our own engagement in this dynamic has helped with this rise of the alt-right.
Asr, why is it the case that if all I'm saying is that mosques and other churches be treated equally and that surveillance not be related to specific religious criteria, and that we focus our crime-fighting efforts overseas where they basically belong? And if I say that, then I join some liberal narrative which ends in I'm a Wahhabi that basically wants you to put a scarf on.
I didn't go that far. I just went as far
madness.
As saying that, yeah, what I went so far as to saying is that you then end up allied with the Wahhabis.
I'm not so allied with the Wahhabis.
I'm saying that's what ends up happening because
who,
you see, John,
I'm not. I couldn't be more opposed to the Wahhabis.
I know that you absolutely are, but what is it that most distressed me about the emails that came out of Hillary Clinton's inbox and John Podesta's inbox, the gifts, right, from governments of Qatar and Saudi Arabia, the Wahhabis, to the Clinton Foundation. So that is then the left, the liberals in our America, getting in bed with the Wahhabis and the Salafis.
Look, I am as offended by that as you, although nobody can be surprised that a United States government is going to be friendly to Saudi Arabia and Qatar. The United States and Saudi Arabia have been in bed since the 1930s, for heaven's sakes. There's no surprise here. That has nothing to do with whether we do surveillance of mosques and Islamic terrorism in the United States. It's apples and oranges. I agree with you. That's offensive. But again,
I'll tell you how it's related. It is related to me because then what those governments do is that they have money sent to these special interest groups. They then put out this idea that we're all under attack, that Islam has nothing to do with extremism, that our mosques are not incubators for radicalization. And then we come to this point where we're at in our conversation that there's absolutely no evidence for that kind of surveillance. But in fact, dating all the way back to the World Trade Center attacks in 1993, you know as well as I do that the Brooklyn, New Jersey mosques were used very conveniently to radicalize the men who were involved in those attacks. I know that this Salafi Wahhabi ideology is being preached, you know, all across this country. I can do like a mosque search, you know, and find the Salafi mosque in my local town.
Okay, fine. I totally understand it. And I think there was a lot of police activity after 1993 in the World Trade Center attacks that broke up and prosecuted the people in Brooklyn and Jersey City. I think police activity was very, very effective there. It sounds to me like you're saying, though, that if you find Salafi or Wahhabi propaganda in mosques in Queens or in Santa Barbara or in Austin, Texas, that police should watch those mosques and that that's going to reassure you as a tool against fighting Islamic radicalism. That's all I want to know. You feel better if the cops are doing that.
I would feel better.
Okay,
because,
great. Then who radicalized Dylann Roof to go in to the church in South Carolina and shoot the black people praying?
So this is exactly what happens, is that my conversation about Islamic extremism then gets equated to Dylann Roof. Like, this is so classic of what's happened over this past year. Do you think that I want us to, have a blind eye to white extremism? Of course not. I want us to monitor any place. If there's a church where there's a white extremist preacher preaching, we should be there. If there's a bar where they're hanging out, if there's any place that they're hanging out, pizza joint, I don't care, a park, we should be there. And so there should be equal opportunity surveillance and monitoring of anybody who has these kind of extremist ideas that can lead to violence.
Okay, that's fine. And I just think that speech is one factor in the radicalization of individuals, but there are all kinds of other factors that we ignore in the United States.
We are going to allow free speech and our liberal principles to kill us, basically. We do this all at our peril. Europe is seeing blood being spilled on its streets from Brussels to London because they have bent over backwards trying to be accommodating. I believe in liberalism. I believe in free speech. But there has to be limits also. And when that free speech includes, you know, basically turning a country from secular governance to political Islam, that's pretty dangerous stuff.
All right, Oscar. Well, as you said, your role as a Trump voter is also to be an ombudsman and a watcher of what happens in the Trump administration. Good luck with that. We'll be with you in that watching.
And I appreciate, John, that you keep me honest. So I do appreciate it. Thank you for the conversation, as passionate as it got.
Oh, absolutely. Oscar Nomani is former Wall Street Journal reporter, co-founder of the Muslim Reform Movement. She had an op-ed in the Washington Post, which she disclosed that she's a Trump voter. Thank you so much, Asra.
Thank you, John. Thank you.
Whether you voted for Donald Trump or didn't, we want clarity. We continue our search tomorrow for clarity on where America is headed and where you think America is headed now that Donald Trump is our president-elect. Tomorrow, a very different view of how this country should deal with Islamic terrorism and its law enforcement strategy. We will continue our exploration with all kinds of voices that may or may not represent the new Trump presidency. You certainly represent our voice. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. Thanks for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.